Purpose-Based Confident Conversations, hosted by Kate Nash, OBE, with guest Sarah Weller, Non-Executive Director for BT, Virgin Money, and Chair of Money and Pension Service. Purpose-Based Confident Conversations, hosted by Kate Nash, OBE, with guest Sarah Weller, Non-Executive Director for BT, Virgin Money, and Chair of Money and Pension Service.
When Sarah is first diagnosed with MS, she asks the medics, "How did I get it? What can I do to make it better? And what is it going to do to me?" Pointed questions that not everyone asks when we first acquire a medical condition that can disrupt our working lives. And because she did not get clear answers, Sarah keeps her information private and doesn't share it too widely. However, unlike the majority of us, she had a huge job. In fact, she was chief executive of Argos. Her story about how she has built her impressive career at the same time as managing disability is very special. And I think her words will stay with you for a long time. Sarah has a plural portfolio career. She is a board director on both the boards of BT and Virgin Money. She is also the chair of the government's Money and Pension Service. Sarah takes us through her career journey with Mars Confectionery, Abbey National, Sainsbury's and Argos as chief executive with 750 stores across the UK. It was, she shares, her perfect job. In our conversation together, Sarah talks movingly about how hard it is to ask for help and workplace adjustments. She offers some great takeaways as to what works for her when asking for help, not least the merit of reminding people that the reason we are asking is because we want to do a great job for our employer. Sarah talks powerfully to the very essence of what it means to be human, and her own honest reflections in this conversation bring out the things we need to do to help those people who come along behind us. These interviews are brought to you with thanks to remarkable people choosing to share their learning about inner confidence so that others can learn faster. This tranche of six conversations in our first series are also brought to you with thanks to LSEG, who are working to create a culture of belonging for everyone. And accessibility is a key part of this. Once you have listened, I ask just one thing from you. Send the link to five others who you think might be able to pass on the messages to five more. We are on a mission at Purpose Base to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence, a strong expectation of a positive outcome, and to share the practical things that we can do to create and navigate our working worlds while managing disability and all the things that comes with. Enjoy this conversation. So Sarah, tell us why this topic of inner confidence matters so much to those people who are tuning in.
I think inner confidence has been a real journey for me as I've learned to live with my condition. I've had to rebuild my sense of who I am in order to be able to explain myself and articulate my story to other people. And that's been about building confidence in the new me, not just the old me, and then being able to explain that to other people. So without that inner confidence, I couldn't tell that story.
As you know, Purpose Base is on a mission to inspire and ignite the flame, really, to help people to build their own inner confidence, particularly in the workplace. One look at your CV, and anyone would be forgiven for thinking that you've always nailed this and that you moved seamlessly through being an incredible C-suite leader, an incredible board director, to having the experience of MS and then just getting on with it. But of course, the story is slightly different. So tell us a little bit about what you do now. And then I want to go back to the beginning of your career.
Okay, so what I do now is I am a board director on the board of BT and also Virgin Money. And I'm also the chair of the government's Money and Pension Service, which provides pensions and money advice and guidance to people who are most in need. So I have what they call a plural career. I do two or three things fitted together. And then outside of that, I do a lot of other work in areas that I think I've got experience in and I can be helpful in. So I've got a real core of things I do, if I like to say professionally, and then a lot of other things that I do because of my experiences and my background that I think I can bring to good effect somewhere that matters.
Yeah. Take us through the journey of your career. It is extraordinary. I had a lot of fun reading your CV and listened to films and podcasts and other things that you have done. And what strikes me is your tenacity, determination in terms of your areas of expertise. But tell us how it started. Tell us about that moment when you knew you had MS.
Yeah.
And then what kept you going?
Yeah. So my career started a long time ago, obviously. I left university, I'd study science, but I decided I wanted to go into business. I didn't know where to go. I applied for 27 jobs on the Milk Round and I ended up joining Mars Confectionery, which was a brilliant choice. It was a brilliant organisation. I loved it. Had fabulous values, family owned, but very large. And I think I managed pretty much every confectionery brand that they had in the UK. And I've invented a product called Milky Way Stars. That's one of mine. And
that was you.
That was me. And I had two children in the process. So by the time I came back from maternity leave after my second, and I was moving my way up through the organization, I got to a position where the jobs were all pan-European. And I had two small children, and that was not going to work. That was a car crash waiting to happen, really. So with some regret, actually, I left Mars and I joined a company called Abbey National, which is no longer there. It's part of Santander and now it's a bank. And I went into a completely different thing. So I stopped selling chocolate bars and I started selling bank accounts. And I spent 3 or 4 years doing that, learnt loads, started to run a big team, which I'd never done before. And I moved from there to Sainsbury's, where I had a big hand in recruiting Jamie Oliver to Sainsbury's. I launched the Nectar card in the UK. So little milestones on my path. And through all of this time, I was, you know, a full working mum. I had two youngsters, doing a fair bit of travelling, but all within the UK. And the sort of pinnacle of that part of my career was I went to work for Argos and I took over running Argos, which had about 750 stores across the UK and Ireland, had about 25,000 people at the low point and lots more at Christmas. And that was my perfect job. I mean, I loved it. It was a fabulous organisation with a great culture.
Why a perfect job?
Perfect because I think it brought together all the things I'd learned and I'd done and that I cared about. It gave me a chance to put into practice the things I believed about putting customers first and putting colleagues who work in the organisation and face customers next, close next after the customer. And I got to run and build an organisation in a way that was my culture values added to the existing business's values, which were very strong, made me feel very aligned. I felt like I was in the right place. I almost felt like I was at home, actually.
Yeah.
And I built my team and the team were very capable. And I got to a point where the team were absolutely strong and I could stand away and they knew what they were doing. And we had a clear strategy. And so it felt like I'd ticked all the boxes. I'd been there for about 3 years when I had my first symptoms of MS. So we'd set up a small operation in India with half a dozen stores and I did a day trip to India. So I went out and overnight had a business meeting, came back overnight. And when I got back, I couldn't feel my feet anymore. And that was my first symptom, really. I went to see a neurologist who said, I think it's just one of those things. Don't worry. Lots of people have this happen. It probably isn't anything. Go away. I went back a year later, still couldn't feel my feet, but nothing else. He said, no, I'm sure it's not MS. It's just, you might be like that forever. A year later, I had some more symptoms. I lost vision in one eye and I lost the ability to run, interestingly, which was part of beginning to lose the ability to walk. And I went back for more tests. When my daughter had gone to the Himalayas, I put the tests off so that she wasn't in the country when I was having them. And I was 2009, I was diagnosed with MS.
And tucking into that, Sarah, because that brings uncertainty and doubt.
Yeah.
To describe the job that you have, that it's a phenomenal amount of work and responsibility,
yeah.
Not least your family too. So what were you doing with the thoughts and the feelings that you had as you're experiencing these symptoms?
I think what was interesting about my diagnosis was I said to the specialist, how did I get it? What can I do to make it better?
Yeah.
And what's it going to do to me? And they said, we don't know how you get it. You can't do anything to make it better. And we have no idea how it's going to progress. So you're right. Your first instinct is one of complete uncertainty about what that means for your future. And to start with, the way I dealt with it was to block it out, if I'm honest, to try to pretend it wasn't there. The symptoms at that stage were minor, visible. If you knew me, you would see them, but possible to disguise it with a bit of help from those around me. And that was what I did for a while. I told my boss, but I didn't tell anybody else. After a couple of years,
I'm cutting in.
Yeah, no, go on.
Why didn't you tell anyone else? Again, what's your
mainly because I didn't know what story I wanted to tell.
Yeah.
So people would say to me, if I did tell anybody I had MS, the usual reaction was, oh, my aunt died of MS. Mm. And I thought, I don't want to have that conversation with people because I might die of MS in 30 years, but I'm not going to die of MS tomorrow. It's not that sort of disease. So I suppose I was still in my own heart trying to work out how I could describe it. When people say, how did you get it? What can you do to help yourself? How is it going to affect you? I knew the answers to those questions were all we don't know because I'd asked the same questions. So I didn't want to have that conversation with other people. So I tried to keep it to myself. I think as time went on, I got more comfortable in my own mind. I lived with it for a couple of years. It fluctuates. So I got a bit of a feel for what the bandwidth was, you know, how much did it fluctuate? And I could see the general trajectory was down, but it was still good days and bad days. So when I got a little bit of a handle on it, I just knew I wasn't going to run that organization forever because I didn't want to be getting worse and worse and worse, being looked at by 25,000 people. So in the end, I went to the boss and I said, I don't mind doing another year. We've just started a financial year. I'm happy to finish the financial year, but I don't want to launch the next one. And after about 2 months of thinking and talking, we decided that I would step down straight away. He would take the business back. He would run it and I would leave gracefully, as he put it.
Was that difficult to get to that decision?
It was very hard. It was an organization I loved. It was a job I loved. It was my perfect job. Mm. In truth, I had a team that were very capable and, it was a very hard decision. But in the face of the uncertainty of not knowing how life was going to progress, I had two youngsters who I wanted to spend as much time with as I could before they were completely left home. And in the end, I'd always said to myself that if my family and my work conflicted, family has to come first. Mm. And this was my first, or probably my second actually, real opportunity to prove I meant what I was telling myself, which was in the end, the family and the time with the family, looking after my health and being there for them had to come first. And it was a very sad day when I left. But it was out of question, it was the right thing to do.
Yeah. Since then, you continued to deliver your great work in other ways. And I suppose my next question is around how have you subsequently continued to build your inner confidence? You know, is it a mixture of self-talk and reading and networking? You know, what is the kit bag that you go to in order to continue to deliver as an extraordinary professional? I mean, your reputation goes before you. So you haven't stopped work. No, you're just doing it differently. But where do you go? Which kit bag do you go to?
I think I start inside myself. Mm. I think many of us know that we are our own worst critics, harder on ourselves than other people would ever be. And I think I've always been that way. I've always been a little bit of a perfectionist, quite high expectations of myself. Mm. I've also learned through some of my later executive career years much more how to use tools to help me to assess my own position. I think in the early days, I was just simply harsh on myself whenever I didn't do anything right. I think what I later learned was a framework for keeping that into some sort of context. Because you're not perfect and you can't be furious with yourself every time you make a little mistake. So I think I had a better framework and structure for that. I had people that I trusted through my career, lots and lots of people through those early years in those different businesses who I used as sounding boards, people who knew me well, people who knew what I was good at and what I wasn't good at, who could help me think about how to apply my strengths to the things I was doing and how not to allow the things I wasn't very good at to get in the way. I did read. I do read. I like, there are many management books, obviously many, many times, not big ones, but, you know, a handful that I can pick out from my past that have really driven the way I've thought about leading in particular. And then the people who are working with me. So I use 360 a lot with my team, people who work for me, people I work for. And I know I'm good down, I'm good up, I'm not quite so good across, and I know that. And then you can get those people to feed you back. And some people say really positive things, and then some people say not so positive things, and you read those. And yeah, so I've always said, in a way, I want to be the best I can be. I was always brought up to say, you've got whatever talents you've got, you've been born with. Mm-hmm. Your task is to make the best of them. And I suppose having MS slightly reframed what my skills were and what I needed to be able to do with them, and opened up opportunities for me to make a difference in ways that I wouldn't have otherwise been able to.
Yeah.
So it's been, you know, silver linings and clouds, really.
Yeah. One of the common challenges within our community at Purple Space, you know, some extraordinary companies who are part of that community, including, of course, BT. Mm. And one of the things that people find so hard to do is to ask for a workplace adjustment or a reasonable adjustment. What have you learnt along the way that has made it easier for you to ask live and in the moment, whether it's transferring from your wheelchair, whether it's getting in and out of a car? What have you learnt about making that live in the moment ask?
Yeah. I have to say, of all the things I've coped with as I've learned to live with my MS, learning to accept help was the most difficult one. Because I'd grown up in a world where I'd been told to be self-sufficient, self-reliant, independent. And a mark of success was not having to ask for help. And then all of a sudden you're in a position where you have to ask for help. You have to have help. Some people are very good at spotting when you need help and offering. Other people aren't. And that's not because they're nasty. They're just a bit oblivious in their own world. You walk around on train stations, people are reading their phones and they walk into you and they just don't even realize you're there. So having to ask for help was always hard. I think the thing that's helped me is I was encouraged at my time in BT, right at the start, to lay out for people a bit about what living with MS was like. And what it gave me an opportunity to do was to describe what MS was, what the version of MS that I have was like, because they come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes, to describe what it did to me and to talk about how I needed help. So this is how I live. This is the help that you could give me that would be good. And by having laid out the football pitch, as it were, that people could play on, what I found was then asking for help became much easier because people knew the background of why I was asking for help. They knew my condition. They understood what I had. They understood that I lived life to the full within the boundaries of what my condition allows. And that in a way, the help they were giving me was help to help me live life to the full. So it didn't come as help out of pity. It came as help out of enablement to live a good life.
Yeah.
And I suppose that context has helped me to feel much more comfortable now about asking for help. And these days I ask for help a lot and I get a lot of help and people are generally incredibly generous with their support. And I always say thank you, even though some days I could have managed without.
Yeah.
I still say thank you because maybe another day I wouldn't have been able to manage without. And so I don't want people to be put off offering help because they don't feel that I appreciated it. So
what have you learned from others by doing that? I mean, what would you be your essential lesson for those individuals who are gearing up for an ask?
Yeah.
Can you think about somebody, you know, middle management, they may have acquired a lower back condition.
Yeah.
They feel unable to ask for a proper footrest and instead would prefer to have a pile of books under the table just to alleviate pain. What would you say to that person about being bold, courageous, and just to make that ask? What have you learned?
I think what I've learned is people are very keen to help.
Yeah.
They're especially keen to help if they feel like they're helping in a purposeful endeavor.
Yeah.
So I think what I would say to somebody is when you want help, you're looking for help in order to be brilliant at what you do. And I think that's what I say to people is, I want to do a really good job for you. And to do that, you're going to need to give me a little bit of help. I'll need a different keyboard. I'll need a footstool or something, because that will enable me to do X that without it, I won't be able to do.
Yeah.
And I think when people say, it will enable me to do X, and we all look at X and go, X is a good thing to want to do, in that case, I'll help you. One of my learnings has been you can see disability and indeed anybody's strengths and weaknesses in two ways. You can see it as a problem to be solved, or you can see it as a thing that if you invest in, you get a better performance, you get an outperformance. And I constantly try to pitch my condition in the context of what it helps me to do, not what it doesn't allow me to do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, got you. What about those moments? Have you ever doubted yourself? I mean, you now sit in boardrooms that can often be male.
Yeah.
Yeah, can often be white.
Yeah.
And very often you may be the only person with a disability within that room. Have there been moments where you've doubted yourself because of other people's stuff? We talk a lot about the soft bigotry of low expectation. Yeah. I don't know whether you've experienced that in a boardroom. Yeah. And what do you do about it?
I have self-doubt all the time, is the truth. And I have done well before I had MS, and it's just a sort of character of me. I think what I do see, because I think I had established quite a strong reputation before I started to enter the journey with MS, that experience is different from somebody who's lived with their condition forever. So I think I think there is very clear separation there. So I think people think of me as capable before they think of the chair, as it were.
You've earned your stride.
And I have. But the things I find difficult are things like social situations. So one of the things about being in a chair is you're at the wrong level. Mm. So you walk into a room and everybody else is having this conversation and you're not able to participate because you're down here. And so it's not so much at an individual level expectations are softer. It's in the more broad social situations or when a lot of people are together. The world is not set up for people who are in wheelchairs. I mean, I often say to people, the world is not built for me. You know, I live in a world that is not built for me. And the whole way the world operates is not built for me. Heavy doors, carrying coffee cups. Well, I need my hands to wheel. You know, there's a myriad of ways in which the world is not built for me. And some of those situations can make you feel quite small.
Yeah.
That's when I feel my sense of well-being challenged, is when I feel like I'm put on the edge because the situation doesn't allow me to participate fully, not intellectually, but just more socially, I think.
I hear you. Do you have any techniques that you deploy in order to better create that feeling of belonging in a networking situation, whether it's holding a glass of wine or canapé? What are your techniques?
My technique is usually to maneuver myself to the edge of the group, and around the edge of the room, there's usually seating. Mm. And then I find somebody and I say, how about you sit down with me? And actually what I find is that people who know me better or are more responsible, who have more experience of this, might anyway come to the edge and they'll sit themselves down. If nobody does that, and not everybody would think of doing that because it had never come across their path before, then it's easy enough to say, oh, I've got too many things. I'm going to put mine on the table. Why don't you sit down here and we'll have a chat? And then I think you can start to move people towards you. What I don't try to do is sit in the middle of a group and talk to people like this.
Because
it's just makes me feel miserable. You know, it makes me feel so conscious of my lack of ability that it's not a good feeling. So, I try and work it into a place where I can engage. And if I'm really honest, occasionally I go into the room quite late when people are just about to move over to sitting down for dinner.
Yeah.
And I go, that's fine. I won't do the front 20 minutes. If it forces me to feel bad for 20 minutes, I'll go somewhere else and I'll come back having missed it rather than sit there and feel bad about it. Because I know I get down if I feel I'm being left out.
It's proactively managing
your own feelings
of the situation. I get you. And sometimes it is about cutting our losses.
Yeah.
And being quite pragmatic and honest about those things that are more awkward.
Yeah.
And having a conscious choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get you, Sarah. One of the things Purple Space has done of late is to create some material, some assets, some publications around how people can build inner confidence. Yeah. And we're on a mission to build a universal and global definition of confidence, which for us is a strong expectation of a positive outcome. Yeah. And to support that definition, we've created six fundamentals and six hurdles. And I know you've looked at those.
Yeah.
Which of those spoke to you? Which of those did you gravitate to?
Yeah, I mean, I thought they were terrific, by the way. And from the very moment I started to read the first fundamental, I was hooked. Because the first fundamental, which talks about the time it takes you to refine your story into a narrative felt like the last 4 years of my journey. And that's sort of what I feel I've been doing for 4 years. I've gone from a position where I was more or less able to walk with one stick to a position where I'm now more or less a wheelchair user full time. And I have spent a lot of that time trying to talk to myself about how I can position with myself how I feel about that journey, and then using it to articulate it to other people. And what I find is, you know, when I started that, I was a bit clumsy about it. You know, I wasn't quite sure how much to share, how much not to share, which bits were going to engage with people and which bits were not. So I feel like I've been learning all that time how to explain the situation in a way that other people can engage with, and that we can both get an emotional up from, because I've people will validate you. So if I explain my story, people will be very supportive. They'll say good things, and they'll say, it's amazing that you continue to contribute. You know, it's really valuable to have you here. It doesn't matter that you can't walk and all that sort of stuff. It's all said with a good tone, and actually, I take it in good heart, because I know where they're coming from. But equally, because I've managed to dispel any worry they might have had about my condition, how I feel about it, I've given them an indication of how they can help me, so they now feel empowered. Actually, they walk away positive too. And it's learning how to have the conversation in a way that you both come away feeling good about it. So that first fundamental about learning to tell your story and evolving it so that it hits the right spots for both you and the person you're talking to was very close to my heart. Mm.
That's great that it has resonance, Sarah. What about the fundamental hurdles? Mm. What about the things, the obstacles that can get in the way? Yeah. Sometimes they're people. Sometimes they're other people. Sometimes it's us.
Yeah.
What were the hurdles that spoke to you?
I think the hurdle that I most loved was the fourth one, which talks about learn to nurture the skill you have in navigating work and life. Because I set my objectives every year for myself. People will find that funny, but at the beginning of New Year, I set my year's objectives.
New Year's Day.
I have to have objectives. And when I was in the heart of this transition, at sort of the most difficult point, I set myself an objective, which was to say, there'll be many things I can't do, but I want to be the best at doing the things I can do. So start to focus really actively on what you can do, not what you can't. And be stretching with yourself about what you can do. It's not just good enough to say, I can do this stuff and I can't do this, but be as stretching as you would have been when you could do more things in a more breadth. And I've actually learned to push myself hard in those other areas and to take pride in what I can do, not to constantly give myself a hard time for what I can't do, but to focus on what I can do and what I'm doing with what I can do and the difference I can make and be more stretching in that space. So that sense of learning to value your abilities and make them work really hard for you and for others, rather than focus too much time on the things you can't do, which is a drain for everybody, I think.
And that takes time, doesn't it?
And energy and persistence, because there are days when I just want to focus on the stuff I can't do and it's just miserable.
Yeah.
But I try to make those days as few as I can, and I try to have them in private. And the stuff that I put in the public domain is the stuff I want people to remember me by.
Mm. I love it. Looking back at the Sarah pre-diagnosis, so the Sarah that was managing Argos on and off planes, what would you say to her now in terms of the things that you have learnt?
Yeah.
What would be the one or two key lessons that you'd just whisper in her ear to have made her last few years easier?
I think I'd have said to myself that your condition is not your fault and it's not a failure. Because I think at the beginning, I thought it was. I thought it was my fault and it was a failure. It was
how?
A weakness.
Because you're a clever woman.
I don't know.
And your medics
and they
are telling
told me
you...
we don't know how you get it and you know, all that sort of stuff. But I just felt, I suppose because I'd lived so much of my life aspiring for as close to perfection as I could get.
Yeah.
And that was both at work, that was in my family life, that was in my school life, in my sporting life. I'd lived my life wanting to be the best I could be. And all of a sudden it felt like the future path for me was going to be one of diminishing capability. each month, each year was going to get worse and worse and worse. My disease is progressive. It goes down. So I think I would have said that. I don't know if I'd listened, but, you know, in a way, I wish I'd learned that earlier. And I think the other thing I would have said is life doesn't end when you can't walk. Because, again, when you live a normal life, walking is such a fundamental part of what you do. You can't imagine how you could ever do anything without being able to walk from A to B. But what my sister said to me, which was brilliant, and right at the start, was she said to me when I was on this very downward trajectory right at the very beginning. MS can start with a big sort of dip, and then I got it back onto a little bit of more stability after that. But she said to me, "You're not just a pair of legs." And I wrote it down at the time, and I remember it even today. And she was trying to say to me, "People don't employ you for your legs." Mm-hmm. And to be fair, my boss, when I told him, said to me, "I don't care if you have to be in a wheelchair going to stores. It doesn't bother me. I don't employ you for your legs either." So people were super supportive, and they were saying exactly the right things. In my head, though, the framing was still, "I've got something. It's my fault, and it's a failure and a weakness." And I think I've learned to turn it from being a failure and a weakness to being a sense of some areas I'm not very good at anymore. Other areas, though, I'm supercharged from where I was before, both in sort of personal skills, I think, because, you know, you learn loads of stuff, but also my ability to provide some sort of guidance and role modelling for others. And if I could have seen, when I was running Argos and I was diagnosed, if I could have seen me today when I was diagnosed, I think I'd have been a lot less scared about the journey than I was at the time.
So powerful, Sarah, as you speak, so powerful. You know, I have the very great privilege of working with a community, and we're forever talking about that journey and how we navigate new truths or old truths. What you've just shared is a very, very powerful lesson. I'm moved. You know this. There's a lot of focus now, not just UK government, but governments around the world, to see what employers can do to improve the rate by which they secure accurate data about the numbers of employees that they employ. And we know yet that is so hard to identify with disability, the experience, even those of us who are so politicised. So that's a very powerful share, Sarah. I know our viewers, our audience will be moved by that in the knowledge of your extraordinary career. So our closing tradition is to ask you a question that was previously put to you. Yeah. So I've got a little question from our last interviewee. And it is, what has been your biggest career regret? So it may have nothing to do with disability, but it might be absolutely to do with disability. But what is your biggest career regret? And if you could go back in time, how would you correct it?
Knowing what I know today, my biggest career regret is I didn't engage more in the ED&I agenda when I was an executive.
So the diversity, inclusion.
Diversity, inclusion, equality. It was invisible to me. I was thinking back to all the businesses I'd worked in. I couldn't remember working with anybody at any level who had any form of visible disability. Now, clearly, there are lots of things that are not visible to me. And I remember going for jobs and people asking me about what I'd done in this area to make my workplaces more inclusive. And I'd effectively presented a blank face to them to say, I don't see inequality in the businesses I work in. It really hasn't been an issue. And that was an honest truth. I had chosen to work in organisations that were very forward-thinking, that I would say in gender sense, were very open. I wasn't in some of the darker corners of industry where it's very difficult. I was in lots of very enlightened businesses. And so I genuinely didn't feel I'd seen any of it. And I think I could have done, not only once I was diagnosed, but even before that, I could have done much more to understand the challenges of people who came from different places than I did. And I certainly feel I could have done more with my own diagnosis sooner had I been brave enough to share the situation with others and lean in to see what I could do with that rather than be frightened of it and keep it hidden away. So I think that would be my big learning.
You're more than making up for it now.
I do my best.
You know, one of the one of the many authors, I should say, that inspired me to write my latest book, John Brown, the BP CEO, who is from the LGBTQ plus community. And he talks about he felt he didn't lean in to sharing his story as a gay man at a time where he could have influenced more businesses. But I think, you know, sometimes our experiences are placed in time and history and rights based legislation, etc. But you're certainly paying it forward.
Yeah. And now. My sense is there are lots, you know, I hope that partly my experience would encourage other people, of whom I'm sure there are many, who are living with some sort of what might loosely be termed disability, who don't feel that they wish to share it because they don't want themselves to be labelled in that way. And I think the thing I say to managers that I meet who might come up to me confidentially and say, I haven't shared this widely, but I've got X, you know. And I say, look, it's not for me to push you to share until you're ready. You need to be ready. But you should know that when you do share, the difference it will make to those around you will be substantial, because if you look up an organization and see people, as of when I was doing big jobs and I hadn't shared my situation, people would look up and they would know that I was not quite right. But they would also know that I wasn't talking about it. And so the message was, if you want to get to the top of this organization, don't talk about having a disability, because the people who are at the top who've got disabilities don't talk about it. So it's clearly not a good thing to do. So I say to anybody who leads a team, your people will be A, super supportive of you. You can guarantee that. And B, you will open a door for them to talk about things. And I watched at Lloyd's as Antonio Horta Azaria, who'd experienced mental health challenges through sleep deprivation, as he talked about those things, the extent to which it just opened doors in the organization for other people to go, crikey, if Antonio can talk about it, then it's actually fair game for everybody. Yeah. And I feel we're not quite there on physical disability. We don't have that many role models who are doing what Antonio did. And the prize was not for Antonio. It was for everybody else, actually. So you share not necessarily for yourself and not primarily for yourself, but actually you share because it helps others to feel empowered to say what their situation is and to ask for the help they need. And I feel like I didn't do enough to open those doors for people when I probably could have done.
Well, you're sure doing it now.
You can't change the past, can you?
Sarah, really, really powerful stuff. Well, thanks to you and the others that we're interviewing through this series, and with thanks to the London Stock Exchange Group, we know for sure that these stories will have a powerful, long-lasting impact on many, many thousands of employees with disabilities. So a huge thanks. So in the tradition, I wonder if you would just jot down your own question to the next interviewee.
Yeah, and I've got a cracker.
Wonderful. So,
I'll just do that now. Okay.
Sarah, thank you for this conversation.
It's been my pleasure, Kate. Thank you.
Purple Space is on a mission to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence for employees with disabilities. Our organisation members can access a growing suite of learning tools in order to navigate our working worlds while managing disability, deafness, mental health and neurodivergence. Notice the fundamentals. Remember the hurdles. Take individual action. For more information, visit our website www.purplespace.org.